Welcome back to The Secret Life of Leaders, where you get unprecedented access to the inner workings of Australia's leading thinkers and practitioners at the forefront of environmental, social, and governance change. The cutting edge of change can often feel lonely, but you're not alone here. The Secret Life of Leaders rehumanizes the experience of life and leadership and creates a platform for us all to learn and grow together. Let's dive in. David Ritter has loved Greenpeace since he was a kid. He says it's his privilege to lead the talented and determined team at Greenpeace Australia Pacific on the mission to secure an earth capable of nurturing life in all of its magnificent diversity. Growing up in Perth and now living in Sydney with his wife Frances, they have two wonderful and curious daughters who provide incredible motivation and encouragement every day. Before joining Greenpeace, David spent more than a decade working as a lawyer, with a particular focus on Indigenous rights. In this episode, David reminds us that together we have the strength, ingenuity, power, and creativity to save the world. So let's get on with it. Welcome to The Secret Life of Leaders, David Ritter. Let's start at the beginning. You're the CEO of Greenpeace Australia. You're also a lawyer, a prolific writer, a husband, and a father. Tell us a bit about your life in your own words and what's led you to devote your life to leading Greenpeace's work around climate change and issues of social justice.
Thanks, Angela, and it's great to be having the chat with you. Look, I think above all of serving Greenpeace, and that probably has something to do with the journey to Greenpeace. I grew up on Brookdon Highway in Western Australia, and Brookdon Highway leads to Albany Highway. And Albany Highway leads to Albany, unsurprisingly, and it was in Albany in 1977 where, in Australia, Greenpeace first became active with people going out in the inflatables, getting in front of the whaling boats. The famous Save the Whales comes from those whaling campaigns. So I really grew up with Greenpeace just being sort of part of the cultural and social and political ferment, if you like it. And probably for that reason, I actually can't remember when I started loving Greenpeace, but it was pretty early on. I had posters on my wall as a teenager. I told this story a few times that I had the Rainbow Warrior poster up there, among others. So there was that deep love there. I started giving a monthly gift to Greenpeace pretty early on when I was a lawyer, along with Amnesty International and a few other organisations I believed in. But that really felt like an expression of my own values. So in a sense, Greenpeace has always been a part of how, you know, I thought about the world and change in the world. And then professionally, well, I went from university to working first for a judge and then a number of years as a commercial lawyer. But my primary work before Greenpeace was as an Aboriginal rights lawyer in Western Australia, work that I was very privileged to be able to do and very fortunate to do. And I learned a very great deal from working for First Nations in Western Australia and to some extent elsewhere. And it all sort of came together when I followed a girl to London, who I've now been with for about 25 years. And that was where I joined Greenpeace. And that was one of those decisions that felt simultaneously very natural, but also I hadn't ever really dreamt of working for Greenpeace back when I was a kid and back when I was putting the poster on the wall and giving the money a month. There's no predestination in it, but that's been the journey.
I read in one of your articles, David, that you were hired for your, I'll summarise and perhaps you can clarify, but you were hired for your willingness to win. And I imagine that strength is playing through some of your campaigning now. You had an appetite for winning.
Yeah, well, look, it's an interesting thing that you've picked out. So the modest story here is that it was Greenpeace UK and they had three positions on offer, and I think they had a strong field of applicants, but two of the applicants in particular had track records with Greenpeace and were, I think, shoo-ins for two out of the three jobs. I got to know both of them later and they were both fantastic people. And I didn't have a background in campaigning. I had a background in being a lawyer. And the chair of the interview panel quite cheerfully told me later they'd decided to take a punt on me. But what I liked about the interview was that they asked me about the appetite for success, about the appetite for winning. And I did like that because I do think that when you take on campaigning and advocacy roles, you should have an expectation that you're going to have impact, that you're going to achieve things. Now, I'm not sure if I'd put it in terms of winning, looking sort of 17 years later, because winning implies that someone is losing. And actually, I think it's really important that we don't think in terms of those kinds of binaries. And particularly when you work for an organisation that is premised on love of people and love of nature and the love of a flourishing world, then winning sort of feels like it's quite a shallow way of thinking about that. So I probably wouldn't use that language these days.
Anymore. Yeah, well qualified. Thank you. And it seems like you've got this beautiful coalescing of your early life, your early career in some of those social issues with some career opportunities all coalescing for the universe to deliver you into this role. And I'm curious for you to tell us what impact you're desiring to have in the world and why you're so passionate about it now.
Well, look, I think the reality is that we are at this extraordinary moment where the world is deep in crisis, and it's in a crisis of ecology, a crisis of climate, and then there are related crises of inequality, of democracy, and so on. And I think like millions of other people, you feel called in moments like these to want to do something about it. And it's, I mean, there's no other way of putting it. It's an absolute privilege to be able to work for an organisation, for a movement like Greenpeace, to serve an organisation, a movement like Greenpeace in a moment like we are in, because it's a genuine avenue, a genuine arena to be able to make a difference. And so when you ask about what the aims are, well, the aim of the mission of Greenpeace is to secure an earth capable of nurturing life in all of its magnificent diversity. I can feel myself starting to smile every time I say that, because it's such a liberating and wonderful mission to have when you trundle off to work. What that means in practice is that at the end of every day, you want to be able to look back on having taken meaningful steps to securing huge campaign outcomes, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, securing the future for our oceans, for our forests, taking those concrete steps towards an earth that is capable of nurturing life in all of its magnificent diversity into the deep, distant future. And the joy and the art of campaigning is that you're seeing that in quite instrumental and strategic terms, that these are not abstracts, but these are things that can be achieved through the careful allocation of resources to strategic objectives by people who know what they are doing and who speak and act with the authority and the democratic legitimacy of the millions of people who are part of Greenpeace worldwide.
There's so many powerful concepts tied up in that response. Thank you. And the threads I'm pulling is you've got this humble, genuine, altruistic vision for what's possible. And I would expect we can talk about this a little later in the face of some really significant and quite ugly challenges. So let's talk about the positive first, David. I just want to give you the opportunity to let us know about some of the campaigns that have been the most successful for you and perhaps what made them so successful as well.
Look, thanks for asking the question, because it's so vital when the world is so troubled and when things can feel so insurmountable. It is so important to remember the things that have been achieved and to learn from them, to take heart from them, and to then feel the energy rising that you want to build on them. So In the long sweep of Greenpeace history, there are things one can point to in terms of the creation of World Park Antarctica, in terms of great wins on, in terms of great achievements in oceans and forests and so on. But I'd really like to concentrate on just the last couple of years in Australia Pacific, where we've seen, for example, the end to the threat of deep water oil drilling in the Great Australian Bight, a tremendous achievement, and not just by Greenpeace, but by a whole coalition of wonderful organisations and communities that work to achieve that result. And I, you know, pay tribute to our friends at the Wilderness Society, to surf riders, to the Mooning people who spoke out, to communities along the coast. It was a wonderful coalition, collaborative effort to protect the magnificent Great Australian Bight and the Great Southern Reef from deep water oil drilling. The sheer power and determination of the tens, probably the hundreds of thousands of people who in some way were involved in that. We've seen the campaign to persuade AGL, Australia's largest domestic climate polluter, to go from being planning to continue pumping out pumping out emissions from coal until almost 2050, and really playing a quite recalcitrant role in terms of Australia's political economy. You know, at one point deciding they were going to sue Greenpeace for making fun of their brand. I mean, that was a terrible decision by somebody, and they lost the case as the best legal advice said they were likely to do so. But we saw in that campaign the end result. And again, through collaboration of a number of actors involved, that company is now committed to coal closures by 2035 or possibly sooner, which almost brings it into line with what's needed to be consistent with the Paris climate goals. This is Australia's largest domestic polluter. It's a massive campaign impact. Or we can look at the re-energise campaign, which what that was designed to do was, again, to really look at scale, and I hope that that's a theme that's coming through on these campaigns. So the re-energise campaign was designed to look at Australia's electricity sector as the largest source of emissions by sector, and then to look at a number of the largest users, private corporate users of electricity that are driving those emissions, and then to go to them and say, look, if you commit to 2025 or sooner for shifting your power generation from fossil fuels to renewables, that's going to be in line with Paris and it's going to make a huge difference. Now, that campaign delivered more than 20 major Australian corporations making those commitments. And you're talking the likes of Woolworths, the likes of Coles, Aldi, Telstra, household names. So not only does that drive a kind of investment in renewables that was so significant that it was recognised by AEMO in its quarterly report, it's also driving employment. It's directly having an impact on the emissions that will be going off into the atmosphere, reducing them. But it's also changing the story. And we were able to track a really significant correlation between businesses making these announcements and then investing in public relations around the announcements and public expectation rising about what business should do to be on the right side of history. So again, an extraordinarily impactful campaign. And look, just coming forward to the last weekend, we've still got a way to go on this, but to see Minister Bowen announce an ambitious fuel efficiency standard, which, if it is turned into law, really does drag Australia into line with where the rest of the world is going on electric vehicles, that's another terrific step forward, another terrific campaign impact. So we can really point to, and I mean, there are others I can mention, but really point to a set of very significant changing the world, changing the atmosphere campaign outcomes driven by just the terrific human beings with whom I get to work and the wonderful, committed, collaborative alliances that come into being around these issues.
Again, powerful concepts, and I just want to pick up on a thread there of affecting change at scale, requiring these alliances and coalitions, and the collaboration that is required for them to form and then to be sustained through to a conclusion of a successful campaign. I don't think we can actually overstate the effort that is required in bringing those collaborations to life. And I just wondered about your reflections there, David, and what you've learned. A lot of the leaders I work with that were in facilitation and coaching are really quite often exhausted by the effort that they put into this collaborative work. And it's a big deal when you're affecting change at scale.
Well, a wise person once said, and I'm not sure where it comes from, but Anita Mitchell was the person who first gave me this line, that change moves at the speed of trust. Collaboration is so important to Greenpeace Australia Pacific's theory of change that it's in our one-sentence theory of change. And the other sort of key component of that one sentence is that we look for where Greenpeace can use its particular set of skills and attributes. So we're looking to make, if you sort of ask how we choose to get involved, we're looking for opportunities where collaboration is possible and welcome, where there's a Greenpeace-shaped piece of the puzzle that we can fill, and where if we're successful with what we're collectively trying to do, we will achieve change at scale. And when one then does enter into these collaborations, the collaboration, like all relationship, takes work. But that's not something you do on the side. That is the work. When you are like Greenpeace, an organization where the power to make change comes from your independence. We don't take any money from any government or any business ever. So that financial independence of not accepting campaign funding is absolutely fundamental. The other part of it is the mass participation from our own incredible crew network, our supporter base. And then the other part of that is being embedded in collaborations. So when that is the core to how you make change in the world, that is the key part of the work. And these are glorious moments, because when you are acting together, when you are acting collectively, when you're in solidarity with partners, it's a wonderful feeling. You know, there's a camaraderie that comes with that. There's an energy that comes with that. There's a diversity that comes with that. All of these things make us collectively more able to affect change.
I love the reference to the energy that's generated when communities of practice organically form around common interests and good people with good intention come together to do good things in the world. And I think the quote of quotes, the change moves at the speed of trust, and collaboration is the work. I'll be taking that with me into my own work. So thank you for that gem, David.
Well, I think I've learned that from others as well. Life's a long journey, and I look back on moments in my own leadership trajectory, my life trajectory, and there are moments when you aren't your best self. And I think I've also had the benefit of learning from some really terrific people. I've had mentors who've been great. I've had peers who've been great. I've had people who, you know, with very good intentions, honestly pulled me aside and said, David, you weren't your best self in there. And so, I just take the opportunity to express gratitude for each of those interventions, because, you know, we're all on a journey, and there are times when I do think I could have been a better self than I was.
Well, I'm appreciating and respecting your orientation to the ongoing learning process that we're all in. And with that in mind, David, what are the encouraging signs of change in dialogue and sentiment, not just in policy and practice, when it comes to how people are engaging with environmental and social responsibility?
Well, I think I'd begin answering that question by, again, sort of coming back to the physical, the material realities of where the world is, and particularly in Australia and the Pacific. And I might share slightly different stories about the two of them. Obviously, well, they're not the same. One is a continent country and the other is a massive ocean-based region. But the The summer of 2020, I think there is no doubt, did have a sea change effect on sensibilities in Australia. And there was genuine anger in the streets about the conduct of the Morrison government. I lost track of the number of people who, for whom the truth of the climate emergency, the associated biodiversity emergency, really hit home and made contact with me in one way or another. And I know that others were having the same experience, others who work within the movement. I think that was a sea change. And I think the only reason why it wasn't even more profound is because the political consequences of that, the cultural consequences of that terrible summer, were then interrupted by the arrival of the pandemic. So we will never know. We can never measure against the counterfactual as to what might have happened. But I think that has left a residue of very, very alarmed and rightly alarmed Australians who are still a constituency of action. And it's worth remembering that, according to the Australia Institute, I think 80% of the Australian population experienced some impact from that summer of fire. So when you have four-fifths of the population who were impacted in just that one set of climate-driven disasters, you really have a mass consciousness of the experience of climate damage. And that, I think, has created a lasting constituency who are hungering for change. And we know that an overwhelming majority of Australians want more climate action, and that includes a majority of Australians in every electorate in the country. Now, I'm Australian, I'm not Pacifica, but the time I have spent with Pacifica colleagues and in the Pacific tells one, of course, that there's a certain generous wryness at any Australian starting to become more conscious of climate impacts, because things are so visceral and so immediate. You know, if you are Kiribati when you're only ever so slightly above sea level, or Vanuatu that has had the number of percussive, terrible cyclone, that what we would see in Australia is consciousness, I interpreted in those deeply climate impacted nations in the Pacific as simply the daily experience, that it's constant, and people from the Pacific Island nations speak with such extraordinary strength and elegance, and yet still generosity about that experience. And then the dissonance that goes with seeing Australia continue to open or seek to open new coal and gas deposits, and how painful that is to see. So, look, I think the long way around of answering your question is that the consequences of the coal, oil and gas industries continuing to exploit the planet at the cost of the rest of us is having a consequence of a rapidly increasing national, regional and global constituency for action.
That was very eloquently strung together. And in fact, David, it's through your writing as well how you can create longitudinal connections over the course of time with lateral concepts that are seemingly quite disconnected and disparate, and glue together a story in the way that you just have to answer a really tricky question. But yeah, genuinely, like, he's clever in the way that he writes, and it speaks to the amount of complexity that you're holding in your thinking, and how you're gluing topics together to create narratives that, as you say, can elevate the mass consciousness and, you know, try to get people's attention and touch their hearts and minds in a way that encourages them to engage with an issue where they're perhaps not sure how to contribute. So I just wanted to acknowledge that in your writing.
Thank you. That's very kind. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes there is a tendency, isn't there, that we want to complicate things, but it actually at base is so extraordinarily simple. So I spent some time in the Northern Rivers sort of exactly a year after the flood struck. And, you know, I had no agenda other than listening. And I spent just some days listening to people who were kind and generous enough to just spend some time with me explaining what they'd seen and how life was for them. And among the testimonies that I heard, I mean, so many of them, all of them are memorable in different ways, but to pick just one, there's someone, a woman living in a van in the backyard of a mate's place because she had no more affordable accommodation, talking about wanting a safe space for her kid to be able to play and flourish, and wanting to be able to be in a place that was safe and clean and full of living things, and wanting to be able to get on with her life and work and the range of things she was good at and interested in, which included music. That's all 8 billion people on the planet. No, all of us crave the ability to flourish, the safe ability to flourish, and for our loved ones to flourish and to be in places that are safe and clean and give us access to a flourishing natural world, and to be able to do work with our life that is useful and where we have autonomy. Now, it is well within our power as a species to be able to deliver that for all 8 billion people and for the only planet that we know to be habitable. And that's the goal. And it is at that level just so extraordinarily simple. And it just stems really from the deepest desires, I think of all of us.
I think that's really well articulated at the simplest individual level. We want the safe ability to flourish. And it's when we scale it up across communities and industries and regions and governments that things become more complex, and we start to have really involved conversations about the best way to affect change at scale. And I just want to touch momentarily on the most challenging part of this experience for you. Like, it's clear, I can see, I've got the benefit of seeing you on video in this conversation, and I can see the emotional investment. It's written all over your face and in your body language. I can see the emotional investment that you have for these issues. So personally, it must be quite challenging, but also as you interact with, you know, politicians and industry, particularly big industry, there must be some very challenging moments in there. And I was curious about what you might like to share around those challenges.
Well, look, first, just to say, to admire the perceptiveness of the observation around the challenge being to reflect those universal desires for, you know, security, love, safe environment, and so on to an institutional level. That is the challenge, and that is why the theory of change must always be at the systemic level rather than at simply encouraging individual behavioural change, because it is only by tackling the system of political economy and democracy that is subjecting people to pain. I mean, the reason why people in the Northern Rivers, or, you know, last week, my home state of Western Australia, people sweltering in Carnarvon, a town I know reasonably well, with almost 50 degrees. I mean, the reason why people are experiencing these extremes is because of the malign institutional corruption of our system by the coal, oil, and gas corporations and other big polluters. So I think it's really important, and I thank you for doing that, to always bring us up to that level of institutions, of systems change. In terms of sort of personal difficult moments in the work, I'm an incredibly fortunate person. I mean, I've had incredibly fortunate life in so many ways. And I work with the most extraordinary team of human beings in Greenpeace, friends and colleagues in the movement around. I've been lucky with mentors. My wife is both my best friend and a partner in sort of the common project of life. And my children are constant sources of inspiration, encouragement, and interrogation. So there's an awful lot of the love, generosity, strength, and wisdom of others to draw on all the time. And then there's the privilege of actually being able to get up and work for Greenpeace. And the strange thing is, I used to sometimes, you know, go to the zoo or watch a nature program or something as a, you know, David Attenborough or something when I was still a lawyer. And I'd have this surge of conscience when I'd, you know, you'd go to a zoo and see that a certain miraculous species was was on the brink of extinction, or a surge of, I remember watching something about the dispossession of, and I couldn't tell you what it was on, a foreign correspondent or something, about Indigenous people being driven from their lands in a rainforest. This is something I would have watched 30 years ago. I can remember nothing except my sort of reaction to this. And, you know, you have at these moments just the sort of surge of, well, I want to do something about this. And it's a privilege where you have a job, where it's your job to do something about it. And I think one of the roles always is to find ways to contribute to meaningful change for everyone who doesn't work at Greenpeace or the Wilderness Society or ACF or any of the other, you know, terrific organisations that do exist. But not everyone can actually work for an environmental advocacy organisation. And the wonderful thing about a theory of change that builds from people taking action is there's a place for everyone in this, and everyone is needed. So, you know, coming back to how I process tough moments or complicated moments, well, it starts from that sense of privilege of working for an organisation, movement that I love and that I feel myself called to serve. And that I think gives one a very good foundation. Then probably the other thing is to always, there's a sort of set of things that I have in my head to think about in just in terms of the sort of question of odds from where we are from here. But a lot of it in the end comes down to being animated by, being motivated by love. And that when you're working out of love, that provides an answer in a lot of moments that might otherwise be quite difficult.
How beautifully expressed. And it reminds me to link in the notes to this episode your writing. I think it was entitled Loving, and I'll be including that article for everyone to read. So thank you for that offering on the way that you manage the ongoing challenges that must play out in your career and life around drawing on those others, those loved ones, and the remembering, the humble remembering of the privilege that you have to be so aligned with your mission in the work that you do, because not everyone has that experience. I also think, you know, it's a really wonderful position to be in with the convening power and alliances of Greenpeace, that you can implement that theory of change at the system level, because a lot of the other people who are really giving it their best to affect sustainability change don't have that convening power and are really focused on local solutions that they're hoping will have a ripple effect. But I think you're in a really wonderful position with Greenpeace there to affect systemic change with the convening power you have.
Well, look, it absolutely takes an ecosystem. And, you know, sometimes Greenpeace convenes and sometimes Greenpeace is a bit player. And sometimes, and the important thing is just to have a sort of, to do your best to take a humble reckoning of whether this is whether it's a situation where Greenpeace should be convening or whether it's a situation where Greenpeace should be taking a support role or even a bit role. And I mean, take for example, we've been honoured to provide support for the case being brought by, well, the theory was initiated in a classroom in Vanuatu, a group of students who decided it would be a great idea to go to the International Court of Justice to get a ruling on the obligations of states to protect citizens and future generations from climate damage. Now, I can tell you here straight, I did not have that kind of vision when I was a law student. So the simple story of the ambition of that Vanuatu classroom is so inspirational. Those students have now been incredibly successful in persuading the national government of Vanuatu, other Pacific Island nations. It's gone to the UN General Assembly and is now going, the first time anything has been referred by consent, you know, from the UN General Assembly to the International Court of Justice. Now, I'm proud that Greenpeace has played a role in that, but our role in that has absolutely appropriately been a support role. And sometimes the right thing is to step up, and sometimes the right thing is to step back. And it's just fantastic to see that campaign led by the inspirational young leaders from the Pacific that are now set up as the Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change. A remarkable group of humans, great leaders.
What a beautiful example of an idea that's come from grassroots and has rapidly scaled to the global level and through your support. So, yeah, appreciate that example. David, I want to switch gears a little bit now, and I want to really get a deeper understanding of what goes on the inside of your mind and your heart as a human. It's coming through your language anyway, but I've noticed your writing often opens with a story of children, and you obviously have your own. And I'm wondering how they might be an ingredient, or what the other ingredients are in you staying so committed and passionate and inspired, given the big, hairy, long-term problem we continue to face into.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think talking to friends and colleagues and team members who are engaged with the reality of where we are on the climate environmental crisis, and, you know, one could throw in some of the terrible violence in the world, inequality and so on, that some of the prospects for democracy and for long-term social equality, that often people do come back to thinking about, you know, maybe if it's their own kids, if they have them, but you don't have to have kids to have kids in your life or care about kids, even in an abstract generational way. And like many of us, I guess I've done the maths and plotted out my own children's life against climate predictions, various models, and against models of fish stocks and forest cover and various other things. And so it does start to become very, very personal when you see that the business plan of a company like a Woodside, which is proposing the Burrup Hub, which is Australia's by far and away the most climate destructive project currently on the books in Australia. And you can see that what Woodside is proposing is consistent with a trajectory for the world that means that the lives of your children aren't going to be good. And that's not only my kids who are now 11 and 14, but every child on earth, that there's a direct clash between the business plans of coal, oil and gas corporations and the prospects for safety, security and happiness of our children. And so you have that in your head, and then you say goodnight to your children. You wake up thinking about them in the middle of the night. Or when I walk my youngest to school, I walk past the childcare centre where she used to go to childcare, and there's now, you know, new generations there that are younger. And you think about this all the time. You think about this conflict, this inconsistency. And I mean, I went to a school assembly yesterday, and it was for Chinese New Year, and I was watching the faces of the children just ecstatic as they were watching the dragon dance. I mean, that absolute excitement and ecstasy in the moment that you see with children when they're so absorbed and engaged in just the miracle of human movement and spectacle and music and sound. And yet I know as I'm watching that all over the world there are boardrooms of executives and of those who would facilitate the decisions of those executives who are planning to ruin their lives. There's nothing indirect about this. There's nothing indirect about it. We the International Energy Agency has been incredibly clear about no new fossil fuel, and yet here are these fossil fuel executives who are planning this. So there's something really dark about that. And so I think I and I'm sure from conversations many, many others have in your head and your heart all the time that sense of obligation and responsibility and love for all those kids who are just, you know, watching lion dances and watching birds and kicking balls around and play acting and, you know, playing with their cuddly toys and their dolls and whatever all over the world, or whatever it might be that they're doing, just being kids, and at the same time knowing the predictions of what could happen and knowing that there are very large, well-funded forces that are pursuing the curtailing of their life choices.
It's sobering. Thank you for explaining it in that way. And I'm observing you've got a really well-developed ability to hold the tension between the positive and the negative, the politics, the industry, the community, the individual over time. And I think that that is quite a special talent. It's quite a necessary talent for someone leading an organization of the size that you are and of the nature you are. And I'm wondering how you harness the energy and the good intent of the people who work for Greenpeace in this region, who maybe don't always have, you know, that well-developed roundedness and maturity to hold the tension between all of those concepts that often seem competing. How do you harness their good intent and their energy? What's your leadership approach in this organization?
Look, I've had good teachers, but I think leaderfulness never it never sits within the formal head of an organization. I mean, I've got a certain responsibility within Greenpeace, but the leadership that exists across the whole of the organization is the profound thing. I mean, we're very proud of the culture we have at Greenpeace Australia Pacific in our staff cohort. And it's not an arrogant pride. It's a pride in the sense of we think it's good, and we think we can live our values, and we think we can be good to each other, and we think we can achieve great things in the world and treat each other well and treat others who are not immediately part of the staff team well. And so that culture, which is codified as a in a way that, you know, is not sort of something that sits in a drawer, but people really sort of live and refer to, that's the web of interdependence in which I've got a particular role to play. But leadership is at every level. And so just to take, you know, one example, there's a fellow who made a bit of press the end of last year when he was one of the team who scaled a 140-metre crane in Western Australia to deliver a message direct to Woodside's boardroom that what they're planning to do to beautiful places like the Scott Reef, which they basically want to put a massive offshore gas mine right next to, not to mention the damage they want to do to the overall global climate. You know, Joe was terrific in that moment, but the leadership that Joe just demonstrates on a daily basis in the way he goes about his work in the organisation, the meetings I've just had before our chat today, Angela, in each one of those conversations, I could relate to you, you know, two or three instances of just leaderful behaviour on the part of the team with which I get to work. So I think we harness each other. And, you know, I draw energy, so much energy from the team, and energy from the team past, from the spirit of the place. I mean, there is a spirit that energizes the work that we do. And the moment when I took quite a few weeks off over summer, and, you know, got into nature and spent time with the kids and all, you know, all those wonderful things, floating on my back in a stream up in the Barrington Tops, all fantastic, all wonderful. But I got back into work and I had this moment of walking in through the back door, and it was all quiet, but there were, you know, a couple of the inflatable, entering in through the warehouse, and there were a couple of the inflatables and some of the climbing equipment. I can see some of the pictures on the walls, and there's a list of things to do on a whiteboard. And it was a moment of just breathing in the smell, the history, the power, the possibility of all that this is, and knowing that it was quiet at that moment, but knowing the team of people that I was coming back into, knowing that wider team, which are the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands of people out there who are part of what is Greenpeace, because Greenpeace is nothing but for the power of the people who believe in the idea of an earth capable of nurturing life and all of its magnificent diversity. And you draw an energy from that, because it is a spirit that is not confinable to a set of words. It is a thing of love and of hope and of creativity and bravery and determination and strategy. It is endlessly bears you up. And so that's what we are harnessing. Like, none of this is about an individual sitting in a room and working it out. This is a collective exercise. And, you know, I'd encourage anyone who's not already part of it to be part of it.
I'm sure they will be after this conversation, David. And I can see you on the video here almost like summoning somatically, viscerally, the words that describe the passion that you experience inside this organization. And imagine, if you will, going to work and being energized by your work and your mission and your colleagues, and actually receiving more energy and inspiration from that than you might even a holiday in nature or on the beach or with your kids. So that's a very powerful message you've offered us there. And just as we're beginning to close out our conversation, but I wanted to ask you how you have personally improved your self-leadership, your personal sustainability, your self-care over the years. Because a lot of people leading sustainability change are burning out or have burned out. And I want to know how that works for you. How do you manage that?
Well, you learn the hard way. Look, I had a particularly, I mean, look, I mean, as I mentioned earlier on, I'm blessed with a wonderful family and support network, and the constant support and collaboration of my best friend and wife, Frances. But there was a particular moment in my first year in this role when I had foolishly got myself into the space of thinking that you could just fix things by staying up that bit later, and it got later and later. My mother died, and there was an emergency in the global organization because we had 30 of our staff locked up in the Arctic by Vladimir Putin's Russia, and among them were a number of people who had ties to the Australian and the Pacific office. So I didn't take any time off to grieve. I went sort of straight back to work, and I sort of finished the end of that year in incredibly poor shape. And I had a couple of people sort of intervene and say to me, look, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. The way you are approaching this is not sustainable. And there was a particular moment I remember when at the end of the year, when our people had been freed, had got out of the jail they were in Russia for a couple of months. And I just started shaking and crying because the grief I'd sort of suppressed from my mother's death sort of all came out. But the longer lesson from that was that there are things that you need to do to keep yourself fresh. And I've had really good advice, really good mentoring about some of the things you can do, that you do need to be able to detach from the things that you can't control in the world. And that doesn't mean to feel cold-hearted about them. It just means that to not take on the responsibility for things that you can't influence, that the mental load. It means paying attention to relationships of trust. You know, all the sort of things around sleep and physical exercise and spending time with people you love and all of those things are so true. I've gone through various morning routines at various times that have been helpful at different moments. I have the least interesting vices of any person you will ever meet.
What are they though, David?
Well, look, my principal vice is the purchasing of fruit and vegetables. So if you wish to terminate the conversation now on the basis that I'm that boring, go right ahead.
Boring.
I love the feeling of being immersed in Sydney's growers' markets, and there are all these people around you all thinking about fruit and vegetables, and you're listening to the thousand conversations, and you have the conversation yourself about whether the peaches are good this week, or, you know, which is the freshest kale or something. So, you know, all those things contribute to keeping you fresh and maintaining that freshness. And look, honestly, also there's reading as well. One colleague suggested that I should not stop reading fiction around the two wars because it would help with a sense of perspective. But long fiction, poetry, endlessly, films, all of it, everything that helps with that sort of broader imaginative way of thinking about the world, it all helps staying fresh. It all helps with the resilience. But probably the number one thing, in a sense, is that when you feel called, you know, it's not work, it's a vocation. When you feel privilege about that. And when you are supported by the companionship, the camaraderie, the sheer skill of the people that you're with, that itself is a great source of resilience, because we are in this together. I mean, there've been moments of setback, climate disaster, and, you know, some fossil fuel company's just done something dreadful, something's happened in the world, and the team gathers around, and whether it's gathering around in person or these days virtually by Zoom, you know, you look at each other in the eyes, you give each other space, but the team is there. And if there is one thing we know, it is that people working together can achieve practically anything. So you look at each other in the eye and you hold the moment and you grieve if you need to, and then on we go.
What profound and sobering and grounding, relieving advice for us all. Thank you for sharing that, David. My last question for you today, and by the way, actually, thank you for sharing all of those strategies that really describe someone who's looking to keep their mind open to fresh perspectives, as well as a full market trolley of fruit and veg. Thank you for that. At the end of every episode, though, I ask, what are the two or three most important things being required of you personally as a leader in bringing about positive change in the world?
Well, Rebecca Solnit, who's one of my absolute favourite writers and another inspiration, and her book Hope in the Dark is always on my desk or not far from my desk, talks about the need to always show up, that you never go home. And I think about that. And my brilliant colleague Vi reminded me the other day of that line from Rebecca Solnit. And it's wonderful. You never go home. But then related to never go home is, you know, my absolute favourite, another source of resilience, favourite rock band since I was, you know, very young, was Midnight Oil. And the lines from Midnight Oil, they say it's late, but, you know, it's never too late. Now, sometimes you're beaten to the wall, but you don't give in. So there are lines about resilience. There's a line from the great war poet Wilfred Owen about, it's a poem called The Call, and it ends with the lines, "A voice I know and I must go." And so that sense of being called to the moment. And so I also think that's part of what I need, what I'm obliged to do, what I need to do every day, is to try and think of what is the moment calling for me to do now as the most useful contribution I can make right now. So I think all of these things are a bit, I'm speaking a bit in terms of abstracts, but actually it's the abstracts rather than the concretes that probably animate how I try and make decisions on a day-to-day basis. And it all boils down to, how do we make the best use of the resources in the time that we have to make a difference for people alive now, for the nature that is alive now, and for the earth in the long future, so that we can secure an earth capable of nurturing life in all of its magnificent diversity?
Beautiful, beautifully expressed throughout our conversation today. Thank you, David. And thank you for accepting this random invitation to be with us on The Secret Life of Leaders.
Thank you.
And for everything you've brought, your heart, your soul, your whole mind to this conversation today, that is clear to me observing you, and it will be clear to our audience as well. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Andrew. It's always kind of someone to want to have a listen in the chat. So thanks for the questions.
I hope you loved listening to this episode of The Secret Life of Leaders with David Ritter as much as I did. His organization is effecting systemic change in environmental and social responsibility at scale through collaboration. He seems to be driven by this deep love for the planet and for each other. And he shared so much beautiful wisdom, so powerfully articulated, about what it takes to lead change at that scale. It was my honor and privilege to talk with David Ritter. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of The Secret Life of Leaders. Make sure you subscribe in your podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We would love for you to share this podcast with friends, family, or colleagues who might be interested and inspired by its content. You can follow me, Angela Koning, on LinkedIn or Instagram. And until next time, lead yourself well and everything else falls into place.